Secretary General Hammarskjöld said one thing about peacekeeping. He said, peacekeeping isn't a job for soldiers, but only soldiers can do it. And I think only good soldiers can do it.
Zento vobis punct meum filium, quem scio tam moribus, quem doctrina habilum et adonium esse, qui admittatur honoris causa, ad gradum doctoratus in utroque jure, cam civili, quam canonico, itque tibi fide mea testor expondeo, totique academi.
Thus did the President of UCG and Chairman of the New Ireland Forum, Professor Cullum O'Hoche, introduce General William Callaghan on the Ides of March, to be conferred with an honorary degree of Doctor of Laws by the National University of Ireland. The General was born in Buttervant, County Cork in July 1921, and having been born during the Troubles, appears to have developed a kinship for trouble and has followed it round the world ever since. He joined the Army as a cadet at the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant 9 months later. The shortened graduation period was necessary because of the war. But nonetheless, the military college had a considerable influence and impact on his attitude to life and his military career.
I think it is the first time I learned perhaps specific discipline at an adolescent stage, outside the home and that, where we had it before. But here we were getting it from different people in a very regimented way. And we were getting it under the command and direction of officers who had started the army, you know, and who themselves were very strict disciplinarians on themselves and in their application to the work. So they applied that very much to the cadet college, and at that time, you know, perhaps the cadet college was more strict than any other part of the army in this discipline. And I'm glad it was.
Is there too much an emphasis on discipline in the army, do you think?
Oh, good heavens, not at all. Not at all. Many people seem to object to discipline who have never been exposed to it. You know, discipline is a wonderful training.
Looking at General Costello, did you ever think that you would reach the same rank?
No, indeed. And I was always amazed at his youthfulness and the onerous task he took on at that time and how well he did it. You know, people often forget that the people the officers who started the army, these are the people who were able to develop the army during the emergency to its high operational status. They were wonderful people.
A fairly blunt man.
Well, that might be even an understatement. He was a very straight man. Where the spade was a spade, yes, indeed.
Would you emulate him in that sense? You have a reputation for being straightforward and direct.
You know, one of the principles of war is the conservation of force or the conservation of energy. And there's no point in beating around the bush and calling a spade anything else than a spade as early as possible, so that everybody knows that there's no point in wasting any other time. Get on with the job.
It is this direct attitude to army life and to the problems that such a life throws into relief, coupled with a determined attitude to sport, which spawned General Callaghan's nickname. He is known affectionately by his comrades as the Bull. Lieutenant Colonel Tom Dunn served as a junior officer with him, both at home and abroad. And this is his perception of the General as seen from the junior ranks.
Looking back on it now that you mention his nickname of the Bull, I'd say a lot of it derived from his physical appearance. Physically, he was a very strong, tough man. I have an idea he was I'm sure he was about 40, 41 years of age at that time. I have an idea he was still playing as a front row forward for the Southern Command team. And I'd say his nickname, apart from temperament, I'm sure it derived a lot from his physical appearance, because I certainly wouldn't care to be in the front row of a scrum pecking down ups at him, that he'd put the fear of God into any opposing forward. Some of my contemporaries, I know, would have the name for being tough men, where young officers, we're here now after a commissioning ceremony, and a lot of these young officers, they would rate, I'm sure, an awful lot of my contemporaries as terribly tough men. But as they go on and go through the system, they'll find that officers just evolve that way, that you can't afford, like Mother McCree's dog, to be going a bit off the road with everybody and letting everybody do his own thing. Otherwise, the army system as such falls down. So there has of necessity to be a certain degree of toughness.
Quinta recounted the three traits of our legendary warriors, the Fianna, traits that still remain admirable today. Truth in our hearts, strength in our limbs, and deeds in accordance with our words. These are the characteristics subscribed to by today's successors of the Fianna, Ogwin and Hayden, one of whose leaders honours the National University of Ireland by joining its ranks of graduates today. Lieutenant General William Callaghan epitomises the more than 25 years of service which the Irish Army has given to the United Nations peacekeeping forces in many lands. During that period, General Callaghan and some 30,000 colleagues of all ranks have followed a long line of Irishmen who served overseas.
To Bill Callaghan and his colleagues in the post-war army, the notion of overseas service seemed simply ridiculous. As a newly independent nation ourselves, we had no colonies to defend or foreign property to protect, nor had we any need for gunboat diplomacy. The army languished a little in the Depression of the 50s, and Bill Callaghan found himself in charge of the FCA in County Clare, a position which some considered to be a bit of a military wilderness. Colonel Dunn.
I wouldn't call the FCA for start the military wilderness, because in those times, again, you're projecting yourself back into the late 50s and early 60s. The FCA then, as it does today, operated on a shoestring. And to be sent out as a battalion commander to the FCA, remember now here the whole of the County Clare, training was conducted in poky little halls or rented accommodation, rented kitchens, all over the area. There was a major problem involved from the word go with logistics, first of all. How do you get people? How do you decide on a training location, for a start? How do you convey people there? Because I think the only transport available to a battalion at that time was one station wagon. How do you organise your night's training? Remember, you may have three centres. At that stage, you probably had three centres going in each location each night of the week, with the exception of Saturday night. You had field days on a Sunday. And from an organisational point of view, to get a voluntary force together for training, to keep them happy, to let them all go home thinking that their journey was worthwhile or that their time spent at the training had been worthwhile, it conjured up all the resources of Barnum and Bailey plus Duffy's Circus, plus you had to be an entertainer, you had to be a diplomat, you had to be a charmer, and behind it all, your purpose was to train them as soldiers. And I'd say that Bill Callaghan's stint with the 22nd Battalion probably did more to mould his character for the role he achieved in afterlife than any particular aspect of his army service.
In 1971, at the age of 50, Bill Callaghan received his first command appointment as commanding officer of the 2nd Infantry Battalion stationed at Carlbrough Barracks in Dublin. Every senior officer remembers his first command, some with greater affection than others. It is 10 years since Callaghan left Carlbrough, and when he returned to his old barracks recently, I went along with him.
General, it's pretty windswept here in Carlbrough Barracks. What are your early memories of this barracks?
I was saying, you know, I came from the Western Command. I had served in all the commands in the army, and I was in the Western Command, and I was transferred from the West here to OC of the 2nd Battalion and the barracks in 1971.
And
You know, that battalion command in any army is the essence of command. It is the time you can apply your attitude and your personality to a unit. It's when you have a close personal capacity of influencing the unit. And when you leave battalion command, you only influence units then through somebody else after that. It's the last time you have the personal influence in a unit. It's a wonderful situation.
What are your attitudes to discipline in a unit like that? Are you a hard taskmaster?
Well, I'm a hard taskmaster, first of all, myself. A very hard taskmaster myself. I start early, I work late. I work very hard and I play very hard. And I expect everybody else to do exactly the same thing in the interest of the unit. And, you know, soldiering is a very complete task. You know, soldiering is about saving people's lives. That is, you have a responsibility for preparing them for battle in all its aspects. You are responsible for what the unit does and fails to do. You can never close the shop, put up the shutters, and go away and say, I won't open the shop again now until Monday. Maybe I won't open until Tuesday. You can never do that with the army. The unit's a 24-hour job, 7 days a week.
You say it's about saving lives, but surely, in essence, it's about taking life.
Taking lives, but saving the lives of your own men in so doing. They must be so proficient as to be able to do the other thing while protecting themselves.
It's also a very powerful position. I mean, the position you have at the moment is an extremely powerful position, isn't it?
I think that would be overlapping. It's a very responsible position, I think. And in identifying that responsibility, yes, there is power in it too. But the administration of power places an awful lot of responsibility on the person who has it.
Can't you destroy somebody very easily and make them just as easily? You can make them and break them. One you say, come and he cometh, and to another, go, and he has to go.
Not just as simple as that, you know, because the whole scene demands a moral application. You know, if you say go and you're going to dismiss somebody, you must be satisfied that in doing so you are justified. And that is a well-thought-out decision and a warranted decision. And it's the same thing if you are going to make somebody or promote somebody. You must be satisfied that this is the right thing and that you're justified in doing it. It's not a personal whim, because you are responsible for what that man will do or fail to do.
Does it ever bother you at all that you may have made some wrong decisions?
Oh, of course, absolutely. Always bothers me. And of course I've made wrong decisions. You know, life is not about making mistakes. It's about the essence of the mistake or the degree of it, you know, because that's why the word mistake is in the English language and in most languages. Oh, yes, this is something I gave at a PNR. These are maps of the Congo. This is a rather excellent map of Katanga, as you see there. This is another map of the same place.
Did you enjoy the Congo?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. A lot of it in retrospect.
Do you think that was the roughest of the assignments you had? I mean, you were in Cyprus as well.
That was a difficult assignment. You know, UN was only starting then itself. You know, that was, we said, 1960. It was the first major peacekeeping operation after UNF-1, which was in Sinai, and which was disestablished in 64 or 67. But the UN was only developing. The military application to peacekeeping was only developing. You know, and the requirement of training and dress and equipment and logistic support were almost unknown. So in embryo, and extremely difficult. We were learning all the time. That's why I think that General McKeown had the most difficult job of any force commander ever in the Congo, for those reasons. The UN was starting, the military side was starting. It was his first exposure to UN. As a young man, he was a very young man, and he was commanding 35,000 soldiers of a whole variety of nations, and Indians and Indonesians and Swedes, Finns, Ghanaians, a whole lot of these. It was a tremendous challenge.
And he did Ireland proud in doing that job.
What is the most difficult thing? First of all, what about the Congo itself? It was your first experience of Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you learn anything there that stood you in great stead later on?
I've learned that it's important to have the loyalty of soldiers and have them very well trained. That's very important. And to be able to manage and look after them.
Bill, at that time, he had been... I think he was OC of the 22nd Battalion FCA. He had been there quite a few years, and I hadn't seen him for a long, long time until we formed up in Limerick in August. I think it was August Monday, 1961. We were due to leave for the Congo in December, but because there had been some trouble in Elizabethville, it was decided that we should get together much earlier than intended for combined training. And the platoon commanders at that stage used to always run and race to get as far away from Bill as possible so that we could do our own things in our own time, at our own pace. But he seemed to be at everybody's shoulder. He was like the guardian angel. Every time you looked behind you, Bill was in the background. And my God, I must say, he really produced a company, that B Company of 36th Battalion, I doubt if ever a company went overseas before or since, which was as well trained as that particular one.
The UN force commander in the Congo was, of course, the Irish Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Sean McCowan, who remembers General Callaghan well.
Callaghan was a man, when receiving a job, went through and saw it to its end successfully. This was something that one came to expect of Callaghan, given a job, that was as good as done at the time it was given. That's how I regarded him.
Now, did you meet him again subsequently? He went on to serve in Cyprus. I think he did 3 tours of duty in Cyprus. Do you think that that kind of opportunity that the overseas service provided at that stage for officers in the army laid the foundation for his success recently as a force commander?
Oh, I have no doubt at all about this. This conditioned Callaghan for his appointment now, and his appointment in the Lebanon, where he performed such an excellent job in a very, very difficult situation. This not only conditioned Callaghan, but brought himself and other fine officers like him to the fore, which would have been hard to detect at home because of the rather mundane sort of life that the army led, particularly before the Congo and before our border troubles became acute.
Now, he himself has said that he was impressed by yourself when you were chief of the UN force in the Congo. And he also was of the impression that you had a more difficult job in your command than he has in his.
I don't regard the job that I had as having been more difficult than his. The word I would use is different. We had two totally different tasks. Mine was a very big and scattered sort of operation. His was a more tightly contained operation, but in consequence, much more easily influenced by political pressures from outside, particularly from the south.
Irish Brigade of the 17th century left on the field not a few. Thomas Davis continued, for in far foreign lands from Dunkirk to Belgrade lay the soldiers and chiefs of the Irish Brigade. Like their predecessors, some of the soldiers and chiefs of today's Irish Army died far afield. stretching from the Congo to Lebanon. Today, we couple their names with that of General Callaghan and express our sorrow to their relatives in their loss.
What do you say to the parents or to the wives or next of kin of people who have been lost under your command?
Well, you know, soldiering is something where you have to accept that there is a possibility of casualties. All that one can say to them is that they have been lost. It's a tremendous tragedy to the family. But in their loss, the objectives which they were pursuing, they have helped to achieve those. And they are remembered very, very dearly for that contribution. And the army is ever interested in the dependence of people who have been lost. And so is the United Nations, very, very much so. And it is a tragedy that if they're lost, but these losses in their own way consider to the maturing of units. That may seem a sad thing to say, but it's very true.
How important is your religion to you?
You know, there's a great saying in the Ahri Torni. You know, I can tell you that religion is exceedingly important, particularly under stress. And the chaplain and the service he gives and the strength religion gives, and not a religion gives to people, is really amazing when they're in tight corners.
But then again, if you look at the religious setup in the Middle East, wouldn't you say that the religions perhaps are partly the cause of the conflict there?
I'm inclined to think, you know, that it's when the religion takes on a political significance, then you're getting into trouble. You know, no religion directs or commands war. It can't. You know, but it's when it's when the influence of the religion uses the military side of things to establish and maintain its position. I think then you get into the trouble. And I'm not so sure that it is religion at that stage.
It certainly is religious fervour, though, isn't it?
I think it is political fervour, perhaps under religious guise.
You think then that the world would be a terrible place without religion? Despite the fact that, religions are at the basis of an awful lot of conflicts.
I think without a genuine appreciation and application of religion, I think society would be much worse. It makes us control ourselves, you know, understand other people's feelings and beliefs. Makes us a better people, you know. Other people would have different views than that, I must say. People are entitled to their own views, but I see it as a very important aspect of life, yeah. Sergeant Rourke, how are you? Joe, how are you keeping?
Pleasure to see you, sir.
Delighted to see you.
Welcome back to it.
I'm delighted to see you. You're looking well.
Oh, very well, sir.
Yeah. The years are very light on you.
Indeed, I'm still at the fitness and the football.
Oh, you have a great shape, I must say.
You had Barry McGuigan in here recently. Had you training before his fight?
It was a matter of whether or not this was the most suitable venue for him.
Yeah.
In relation to...
Training. And did he train here?
He spent several hours here, in fact.
Is that so?
And apparently it wasn't the most ideal that he wanted.
Yeah.
The gym itself, there was no problem.
But
apparently there was a few other minor factors in this.
I see.
It would have been nice to have him on.
You've got a new floor.
Great. See you.
I am, sir.
What's the basketball team like, what? The band still, I suppose, are the top notchers, are they?
They're the top.
Huh?
Not exactly as good as they used to be.
Is that so? Mm.
Yeah. But it's used very extensively.
Yeah. A gym team, have you a gym?
We have, sir.
Yeah. So good one?
Well catered for.
Yeah. Way. Very good.
Do you spend much time keeping fit yourself, General?
I do, as a matter of fact. I as I said to you, I work fairly hard. I keep very active in Unifil. I spend as much as time as I can in the field with the soldiers, and that means walking a lot and travelling a lot. And then I try and regiment myself to about an hour to 2 hours brisk walking every night or during every day. And that helps me a lot to keep fit.
You've spent quite a long time away from your family. Do you regret that?
No, I certainly don't regret it, but I appreciate very much their making me available to go and taking on the responsibility of 7 children and looking after them and taking the responsibility while I'm away. You know, that's a wonderful support. Because, you know, you go overseas as a volunteer. You are not sent. You have to make the decision. You volunteer to go. Now, in volunteering to go, you must have the support of your family and your wife and family to continue on in your absence. And without that support, it is not possible to get the exposure.
Having the full support of his family enabled Callaghan to throw himself into his work abroad with total dedication. And he has used his time well, picking up on the small, important diplomatic skills, like remembering people's names years after he had met them. This is particularly true of soldiers who have served in units he commanded. And he also believes that the rapport between officers and men has changed radically because of overseas service.
Of course, there is no doubt about it. As I was saying, that it's command by participation. They are living with the men for 24 hours of every day, 7 days a week. So they get very, very close to the men and very appreciative of the capacity and the calibre of the men and the variety of talents they have. And a lot of these talents haven't seen until they go overseas, where you find that you have an excellent cook, and he may be a driver at home, but he turns out there to be an excellent cook.
Sir, 848613, Sergeant Cole, today, Miss Cadre. Welcome back to the mess.
Thank you very much indeed. When were you in Lebanon?
46th and 55th, sir.
46th and 55th. What job had you had?
Well, my first job out there, the 46th, was section commander with number 1 Battalion. Mm-hmm. And I was platoon sergeant, number 2 platoon with the 55th.
Where, in Brashies or where?
Well, we done a 2 month stint.
The rotation in East
Yeah,
Bend.
We started in Haddad. We started in Brashies and finished up in Harris.
In Harris.
Yeah.
Enjoyed both trips?
Enjoyed them very much.
Nicky Broderick, how are you? Good to see you. How are you keeping?
Good.
Colin, you're looking very young. You're looking very young.
We got to don't feel it.
How's the family?
They're all reared up now.
Have you left the Audley room? You have?
I have.
You're up at A Company, is it?
Up at HQ.
HQ Company. Giving them advice. You're kind of an administrative consultant with a lot of advice to give.
That's right.
This was the Audley room sergeant, a wonderful man who looked after all the administration of the unit. Really wonderful.
Callaghan entered the Defence Forces in 1939 and was steadily promoted through the ranks until he was appointed Lieutenant General in 1981. His appointment in that year as the Second Force Commander of UNIFIL, the 6,000-strong multinational United Nations interim force in Lebanon, was an honour not only to him but to Ireland and to its army. Among those who serve under him and who, in the performance of their duties, apply patience and tact rather than firepower, are soldiers from France, Fiji, Finland, Ghana, Holland, Italy, Ireland, Norway, Senegal, and Sweden. Peacekeeping warriors all.
During his various tours of duty with the UN, Bill Callaghan came to know how the system worked, and more importantly, what was expected of peacekeeping forces. When he was promoted to the rank of colonel in 1976, he was 55 years of age. Many in his position might have thought of retiring. Instead, he took an appointment as a senior staff officer with the United Nations Truth Supervision Force. From this appointment on, Callaghan would never look back. 2 years later, in March 78, he became acting chief of staff of UNSO until 1979, when he returned to Army headquarters in Dublin and was appointed assistant chief of staff with the rank of Brigadier General. Further promotion came within a year, and this time he became Adjutant General of the Defence Forces. Callaghan by now had made many friends in the UN, both military and civilian, one of whom is the Chief Administrative Officer of UNDOF, based in Damascus, and whose name is James Conley.
I first met Bill in Zigi Camp in Cyprus when he was Contingent Commander with UNFISIP. And during that period, I knew him mostly in the social life, mainly by the great hospitality he showed to the civilians of UNFISIP, and particularly the Irish civilians. There were about 10 of us there at that time. We never missed a party in Zigi Camp, an Irish party. I heard at that time about Bill's reputation of being a tough man, but frankly, I never saw that side of him when he was in Cyprus. Later on, when I moved on to UNSO, I worked more closely with him because he became acting chief of staff in 78 and I happened to be in charge of administration in an acting capacity also at that time. So we had to work very closely together for many decisions that had to be made in the mission from day to day. And during that period, I found him to be a champion of everybody who was... In other words, he was very keen to show fair play, always. And I found that his toughness was more towards his superiors than to his subordinates. That was my experience with him. In fact, he was a great champion of a group of field service officers, which are mainly the civil service types in the UN. Because the field service are isolated from UN headquarters in so much as we have no real representation there except the office we deal with. And so the cause was often left to be fought by people like Bill. And Bill never lost an opportunity to promote the field service people.
The person responsible for appointing Callaghan as commander of UNIFIL was the Under Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Brian Urquhart, who retired in February this year. Mr. Urquhart was with the United Nations since it was founded, and he established and was responsible for all its peacekeeping operations. Why did he choose Bill Callaghan as commander of UNIFIL?
Well, I think for a number of very good reasons. In the first place, he's someone that we knew very well from a whole series of past peacekeeping assignments in the Congo, in Cyprus, and in the Middle East. He had very recently at that time been the Deputy Chief of Staff of the United Nations Truce Supervision Organization in Jerusalem, which is an organization which spans the whole series of Middle East countries we deal with. And UNIFIL is a particularly difficult job, and it does require someone with proven experience of that very complicated area. It requires somebody who really understands the basic problems which UNIFIL was facing, which were extremely complex ones, somebody who knows the people involved, and somebody who's proved that they can function capably in that very difficult environment. And that's why we wanted Bill Callaghan. And of course we wanted someone from Ireland, partly because there's an Irish contingent in UNIFIL, and partly, I think, because we felt that it was a very good nationality for this particular and very difficult job. And we wanted to be sure we got someone who really could do the job and could settle right in, because there wasn't any question of learning on the job in UNIFIL. You have to have somebody there who can do it right from the first go, otherwise it's too complicated. But General Callaghan, in the first place, is an extremely good sort of all-purpose peacekeeping soldier with a great deal of experience. He's got a very level-headed view of things. He's very down-to-earth. He is tough. He is extremely fair-minded. And he doesn't get rattled when things don't go according to plan, which they absolutely never do in Lebanon. I mean, if you start going in one direction, be perfectly sure that things will go in the other direction in the next minute or so. I mean, it's a very complicated area. And I think for all these reasons, we wanted to have someone in this most difficult of all peacekeeping commands who we knew and who we knew had the qualities to exercise the command. And I think that Bill's mixture of down-to-earth qualities, toughness, and knowledge of the area were a very good mix for this particular job. And I think he's been in that job far too long, as a matter of fact. He's only just left it. He's been in there for 5 years, which is longer than he should have been, because it's a very, very demanding job.
A weakness in the peacekeeping force was exposed in 1982 when the Israeli army invaded Lebanon. Because of the mandate which the Security Council had given UNIFIL, the force was powerless to do anything about the invasion. There is a wrong perception of the role of the force, Callaghan insists. It is the difference between peacekeeping and peace enforcement.
Peacekeeping, as an operation, is providing a conflict control mechanism to allow parties to stop fighting and continue by cooperation to make peace. Such a concept is based on the acceptance of a force on a broad political base, agreement in the Security Council, and consequently a lightly armed force for self-protection. Now, peace enforcement is entitled totally different. It envisages a force to enforce peace by military means, which means agreement in the Security Council to a force armed suitably to carry out that purpose.
Bill Callaghan's career over the last quarter of a century mirrors exactly the Army's involvement with the UN peacekeeping operations. It has also brought honour and distinction to the country and to the Army, views which were expressed by the Minister for Defence, Paddy O'Toole, and the Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Tadhg O'Neill, when General Callaghan received his degree. Firstly, the views of the Minister.
For the country as a whole, it has been a great honour and privilege to us as a nation to have people of the calibre of the General at his present post in UNIFIL, and indeed for the Army personnel themselves. I think they can take pride in the fact that here is an Irishman, one of their own, getting international recognition for what is a very important job, one of the most difficult indeed, as has been said, in United Nations operations so far in the peacekeeping area. So all of that adds up to something of great significance for Ireland as a whole, for the Irish Army, and indeed for the gentleman himself, General Callaghan.
Thinking back to the first groups that we sent to the Congo, it is good from a soldier's point of view to see the developments and the changes that there have been since then. We sent soldiers to the Congo in the green uniforms that were designed. Designed for fairly well designed for service in this climate. Well, I don't need to say that there's a difference in the climate.
Yes, I think we all remember them walking out to the Globemasters in Baldonnell, and even that has changed now.
And the soldiers that went there remember walking off the Globemasters in the Congo in those uniforms. So there have been great developments. I suppose one of the biggest changes there is from our point of view now between the Congo and then, of course, it is a quarter of a century later, is the communications. It was a very big problem when we sent our first contingent to the Congo. The communications were, at best imperfect. Whereas now we can dial our soldiers on the public telephone system in Lebanon, and we can speak to them, and that is a tremendous help to the soldiers themselves. They don't have that sense of isolation that was very real and could be a problem.
His overseas duty in the cause of peace was acknowledged by the award of 4 United Nations medals. These awards reflect honour not only on the General, but also on many, many other members of the Defence Forces who served and still serve with distinction in the cause of peace. The citation for the Distinguished Service Medal awarded to General Callaghan in 1984 reads as follows. For distinguished service as commander of the United Nations Force in Lebanon, where he has displayed outstanding qualities of leadership, resource, and devotion to duty. His successful handling of a very delicate and difficult situation has enhanced the reputation of the Irish Defence Forces and made a significant contribution to establishing stability in the area, thus contributing generally to world peace. It is generally accepted that the task of UNIFIL is the most difficult peacekeeping operation ever undertaken, and it is a source of pride to all of us that a fellow countryman should lead and guide this international mission so successfully.
Well, you know, Emil, it's a wonderful honour for me unworthy do I am for that degree. And I think I would be, if I wasn't a little chuffed at getting it, I would be less than human. But I rather think that this degree is for the army. It's a recognition to the army for its association. It's a very successful association with peacekeeping in 25 years. And I'm very happy for that. And I'm particularly happy, I think, because this is also a recognition to the young soldiers. And these actually are the people who make peacekeeping possible. The young soldiers from Ballyfermot or Ballysadare or Kildymo or wherever. These are the young chaps who are at the checkpoints and at the flashpoints where incidents happen. And it is their judgment and their maturity and their professionalism that makes peacekeeping work. Many people think that at each flashpoint there's a diplomatic general with a lot of experience to solve the problem. It isn't. These problems are assessed, confronted, and solved by young soldiers, 17 and 18, and young corporals and young officers. And they're a wonderful credit to the peacekeeping force, to the army, to their units, and perhaps in a particular way to their families, who give them the moral character, and to their teachers, their national teachers, who do an excellent job in producing excellent young men.
Ego ac toritate me contessa admito te ad gradum doctoratus in utroque iure.
UNIFIL started in South Lebanon in 1978. In its present area of deployment, there were slightly in excess of 10,000 Lebanese living, because they had been forced out by the circumstances of war, bombings, actions, etc. The majority population had moved out to the north at that time, in Beirut, etc. Now, in that same area of deployment, there is in excess of 400,000 Lebanese back living family lives, village lives, children going to school, shops open, stocked with goods, the services being run, the hospitals are opened, tobacco is being grown, and perhaps the most normal life in Lebanon is being lived in that area. I think that's a tangible indication of the success of UNIFIL. It has brought back the people, and there is no peace without people.
There is no doubting the benefits which UN service has bestowed on the defence forces. No doubting either that General Bill Callaghan found his métier in the Middle East, where he has proved, despite his nickname, that he is no bull in a china shop. But why is it, I wonder, that Irish soldiers suit their UN role so well?
I think it's perhaps the nature of the beast. We are good communicators, we are good talkers, we are good listeners. And, you know, we have what a lot of other nations don't have. We have a fair good quantity and quality of cunning, I think. And that, I think that is important in the international scene.
Well, I know an awful lot of people generally who would say that you have a fair measure of it yourself.
I'm amazed that you're saying that.
Ha 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 ha.